This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Triangle was a hotbed of indie and punk rock in the 80s and 90s, and Superchunk was squarely at the center of that scene. With a gritty DIY ethos, the band pumped out songs like Hyper Enough. Laura Balance is bassist for Superchunk, a band that went on to become an indie rock institution. Laura herself became an icon in her own right, co-founded the once scrappy little record label that has since become a beacon for artists in the South and around the world, Merge Records, which turns 30 this year. Laura Balance joins us in the studio today. Welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Good to talk with you. Listen, for those of us who were not there, talk about Chapel Hill's music scene in the late 80s and 90s.
Let's see. It felt like a pretty tight-knit and small community. I guess for me, when I first moved to Chapel Hill in 86, mm-hmm. Some of the first people I met were Dexter Ron Weber and Crow, who drummed for him in the Flat Duo Jets, and the guys from Zen Frisbee, they were all sort of like, you know, I don't mean this in a bad way at all, like sort of smelly hippies.
Yeah.
But the punk rock hippies. And it was very friendly and sweet. And
Talk about the impact of the Cat's Cradle in bringing people together, I guess keeping people together, creating maybe what we'd call a scene.
Well, the Cat's Cradle is 50 this year, and we have to figure out how to make Frank celebrate that, by the way. But it's been in Chapel Hill as a place that local bands could play for a long time, but also that bands from around the country could stop and enrich the culture of Chapel Hill and inspire local bands to play and perhaps get out of town too. That, like, the Cat's Cradle, along with all of the local radio stations, because we have, you know, the good fortune of having these three cities close together, right, with three universities in them and three great college radio stations.
Yeah,
you
got some good college radio here.
So, and we also in the 80s had a lot of great record stores. So it was this perfect.
Yeah.
Storm of music support, and so people just felt like, you know, anybody could be in a band. You didn't have to have gone to music school. You didn't have to be particularly talented. You just had to figure out how to do it, and that's what everybody was doing.
Well, let's talk about how you got involved in this and retrace some of your steps. Born in Charlotte, but you grew up a lot of places, including Goldsboro. Tell us a bit about your early years.
Let's see. I was born in Charlotte. I don't remember living there at all. My first memories are of moving to Goldsboro. My parents were kind of like, I don't know, half hippies, and they eloped. Theirs was a forbidden love. I feel like my childhood was kind of chaotic, and a lot of it has to do with possibly my mother's side of the family was pretty dramatic. My father's side of the family was very cut and dry for the most part. He's from Hatteras Village at the bottom of Cape Hatteras. Uh-huh. And they, you know, when he was growing up, there was no road on the island, much less a bridge to the island. And people really had to be no-nonsense and self-sustaining out there. And so there's that side of me. And on my mom's side, her mother went to Juilliard and studied music. And her father was an investment banker in Charlotte. And he my grandfather on my mother's side was really into jazz and went to a lot of jazz shows. But also, I remember him wearing these hippie shirts when he was home, after he'd get home from the office, and reading Carlos Castaneda books. And I suspect he may have done some drugs.
Well, so not only saying you think about Carlos Castaneda and some of these kind of perhaps the drugs, but also this idea of some other world, the paranormal. This is an important part of your upbringing as well.
Oh, absolutely. On my mom's side, particularly, every time we'd go to visit my grandparents in Charlotte, they would. After dinner, they'd have had some drinks, and they'd get out the Ouija board. And all of us kids would still be around as it started. And, you know, we'd watch them, and there would be these dramatic exchanges with various spirits from the other side. And there was also a house spirit that protected them, supposedly. His name was Christoph. And we would sometimes think that we saw him outside the windows. Like we could see him looking in, which, you know, I don't know if that was just an overactive imagination on the part of us kids, but definitely things happened in that house. And
well, like what kind of things?
For me, one of my most vivid personal memories is one time I was staying with my grandparents, and this was during the daytime even. I rounded the corner to go up the stairs up to where the bedrooms were. And as I was coming around the corner, I look up and I see two figures sort of floating down the stairs towards me, holding hands. And the one weird thing about it was one was sort of reddish and one was sort of bluish. And I turned around and ran away. But, like, I never forgot that.
Now, did you feel free to report these things? Obviously, these are people who pull out the Ouija board, so you
right.
might feel free to report these kind of things to the family, or didn't you?
I'm sure I told somebody.
And you talk about a house spirit, and it's a thing that was palpable enough. In other words, they talked about it in a way.
Oh, yeah.
This is creating images, and would it govern behavior? You know, we're not going to do that because Christoph said don't?
No, he was never like a disciplinarian, except one time. They had sent us to bed. Often after they got the Ouija board out and got things going, they would get like, okay, kids, time to go to bed. And, you know, me and my cousins would just, you know, we'd wander off and make our way to the bedroom through the dark. Uh-huh. And I remember one time we were upstairs. We were supposed to be asleep, but we had the lights on. We were jumping between the beds, playing around, and suddenly the lamp goes click and turns off. And we were all just like, and we thought, Christoph has decided it's time for us to go to bed.
That's good. Well, what did you make of the other episode, the couple coming down the stairs in 3D vision? Well, I mean, what did you make of that?
It was a normal part of my reality. Yeah. So, it scared me. I didn't feel personally threatened by it, but I didn't want to interact with it the way that it seemed to want to interact with me. I don't know. It was just part of my reality, but one that I couldn't count on. It would just appear all of a sudden sometimes, and often would surprise me. Like, it never happened when I was looking for it. It was always when I.
Was it that things that palpable, that like human figures, or did you experience things in other ways that were sort of.
Yes. Let's see. When I was 18, I was staying at my mom's house in Raleigh. So this is a different location even. Yeah. So it follows me around. I was going to UNC, and I would go back and stay in Raleigh at her house sometimes when I was visiting friends in Raleigh. And I had come in late. It was like 3 in the morning. And my stepfather was a little bit of a prankster. And sometimes when I'd come home late at night, I would hear Hard Soul Shoes walking around upstairs and at 3 in the morning. And I thought it was, oh, that's Dan. What a jerk. But in hindsight, I wonder. But anyway, one night I was on the verge of falling asleep and suddenly snapped back awake because I could feel something pressed up against my back, like a person laying next to me in the bed. And I'm certain that no one had gotten in the bed with me. And I did what any sensible person does in that situation, and I closed my eyes and sweated and just prayed to go back to sleep.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to turn around and see what it was.
You said you shut it down after that.
I did. I did. That one scared me so bad because it was the first time I had been physically touched by whatever this was. And I decided I didn't want to have it anymore. And I made a decision to close whatever that door was. And like, I miss it sometimes.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about you, Laura Balance, and your career with Merge Records, Superchunk, and a little bit about the way these intuitions may have fed into your career and your life. Talking to Laura Balance, the co-founder of Merge Records, bassist for the indie rock group Superchunk. Merge turns 30 this year. We'll talk about all of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Speaking of Superchunk, here's Precision Auto from their 1993 album, On the Mouth. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow talking to Laura Balance today, co-founder of Merge Records, the indie label, turned 30 this summer, also bassist with Superchunk. Tell me a little bit more about that experience, though, this moment that you had. You'd have these intuitions, visions, call them what you want, senses of something that other, that maybe we don't all experience, and you turned it off. What did that do for you later on, in terms of sort of how you developed as an artist and a musician? Do you think?
What it did for me in my life was it made me feel like I had a little more control, and because a lot of my childhood felt very out of control. I value control very much. Definitely to a fault.
Let's talk more about that, because you did have one episode in particular where it was an upsetting episode that really gave you a sense of total loss of control when your family, you had an intruder.
Right. We were living in Little Rock, Arkansas, I don't know. There was something about this house. It was like it was trying to kill us. but over and over again, bad things would happen in this house. Like, we had gas leaks all the time after we moved in. My brother fell through the floor of the attic into, you know, down a story. And there was this outrageous storm one night where lightning hit the house and this giant oak tree in the front yard, blew out the air conditioning and the electrical in the house, and shattered this oak tree into smithereens. And so the next few days we had to sleep with the windows open in July.
And how old are you?
I was 8.
All right.
And my mother and my brother and sister and I were sleeping in the living room, which was a more open room with a high ceiling. And my father was in the bedroom down the hall. And I remember waking up and there was a man halfway in the window, sitting on the windowsill. And our dog was barking at him. And he looked at the dog and said to her, "Shut up, or I'll shoot your kids." And she turned tail and, you know, hid. She walked away and went and hid somewhere. And he came in, he proceeded to herd us around the house and told us he was going to kill us. He shot at us. But I think he didn't, he wasn't trying, like, he could have shot us, but he didn't. But there were bullets flying around the house, and herded us into the back of the house and put my father, my sister, my brother, and I in the closet and raped my mother. And then left. And I'm not sure how long this whole thing took. It felt like forever. Yeah. But it was obviously, it destroyed my reality. It changed my idea about what the world was. And I mean, it changed me for the rest of my life. I feel like I have PTSD, and I think, like, I feel like I have brain damage, you know? And I guess that is kind of what happens. My brain doesn't work like other people's anymore. It's challenging to stay present sometimes, especially if I'm triggered or feel anxious. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was really difficult when I started playing in the band, because it wasn't something I ever sought out, really. It was sort of, Mac wanted me to do it, and so I did.
You mean playing in the band?
playing in the band?
The bass, yeah.
Yeah, playing bass in the band. And I think up to that point, I had spent a lot of my life trying not to rock the boat. And I didn't want to hurt people's feelings. I didn't want to say no to people if you know, they made a reasonable request, like, will you play bass in my band? and so I tried, and I was terrible at it. I was so bad at it because I was so scared, and I would have tunnel vision and feel like I couldn't breathe, you know, feel like something was sitting on my chest, and I would, if anything went the slightest bit wrong, I would retreat into my little lizard brain, and my lizard does not know how to play any songs at all.
That's the wrong direction for a performer under stress, right?
Yeah.
You want to lash out and you're going inside. Well, now that we're here, take us back and talk about your introduction to, I guess, the punk, the indie scene here, how you and Mac McCann met, and how did the band come together?
I was at UNC. I was in my sophomore year, I think, when I met him. And he was taking a year off from school at Columbia and living in Chapel Hill, at Columbia University in New York. And he was in Chapel Hill working at Pepper's Pizza. And I started going in there, and I met him and another friend there. And I started working there also. And so we were, you know, hanging out all the time, standing around making pizza or whatever.
Well, were you involved in music at all? What was your connection with the music scene and his connection with the music scene, if any, at the time?
Let's see. Before I started, it's so convoluted. But before I started school at UNC, I had lived in Raleigh for 1 year. And before that, I lived in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And while I was in Atlanta, I got into punk rock. And I think that punk rock appealed to me because it seemed to be an embodiment of the otherness that I felt. I felt like I didn't fit in anywhere. I wasn't normal, even though I wanted desperately to be normal. Mm-hmm. I wanted, in middle school, I remember looking at the kids, the preppy kids with their Izod shirts and their Gloria Vanderbilt jeans, and just being like, why can't I be like them? Why can't I hang out with Tracy Turville? Why don't I get invited to their birthday parties? And it was because I was an introvert and a weirdo, and I didn't fit in. And when I first, I think one of my big introductions to punk rock was actually strangely on TV. Atlanta was one of the places where early cable TV mm-hmm. started because of Ted Turner. And we had cable really cheap, really early, and he was desperate for content. And there was all kinds of crazy stuff on TV. And one of the things I saw...
Unlike today. Go ahead. No, no, I take your point. Go ahead. Go ahead.
There was stuff from all over the world, yeah, though, that like I wouldn't have had access to otherwise. I mean, mm-hmm. it wasn't just the Dukes of Hazzard. It was also strange Japanese cartoons uh-huh. that were translated and, just awesome stuff.
Yeah.
But I saw this live performance. Well, it wasn't live. It was recorded. But it was Adam and the Ants on a set made out to look like a pirate ship. And, I can't remember if it was Kings of the Wild Frontier or... It was Kings of the Wild Frontier, and which is an Adam and the Ants album, by the way. It spoke to my 14-year-old self. Like, I was like, that's it. They're all wearing makeup and crazy outfits, and that, like, androgyny and rebellion that I could sense coming out of them, like, I just latched onto it. And I wanted to be them.
So that's Atlanta. Meanwhile, as you say, then you spend another year in Raleigh, mm-hmm. right?
And there is where I got embedded in the Raleigh punk rock scene, and there were a lot of bands coming through and playing at the brewery there, mm-hmm. and I got to know some of the people in COC. And elsewhere around the Raleigh music scene, and then I moved to Chapel Hill. So, I had feet in both scenes. And the Chapel Hill scene seemed a little bit more affluent than the Raleigh scene. It's interesting, like, the differences in the scenes. But, like, it was more people whose parents were lawyers and professors.
Not so much angst as ennui. but anyway, it's going to look a little the same. So where does Mac fit into all that? And then again, is he having some of the same ideas? Do your interest in music merge, if I may, on this 30th anniversary?
He also was really into punk rock. He was more of a punk rock scientist than I was. He knew about every obscure 7-inch that had come out and had already made contact while living in New York with Gerard Cosloy, who had a fanzine called Conflict. Mm-hmm. And Gerard later wound up starting Matador Records along with another guy, Chris Lombardi. But...
So there's an interest, a mutual interest in the music. He may come at it from a little more, sort of the historian and the scholarly point of view. What about the band? Where did the idea for the band, had that been perking in his mind a long time, or did he look at you and say, let's start a band? How did that
happen? He had already been in a few bands. He was in a band called Slush Puppies with this guy, Jonathan Newman, who is a mutual friend. And he always was starting bands. It was amazing. Yeah. I feel like at one point during that year off, he was in like 5 bands. And he asked me to be in a band with him. And we started playing. It was him and Jonathan Newman and I. And since I had never played an instrument, he and Jonathan both had to play instruments they didn't play. So Jonathan was a drummer, but he played guitar. And Mac played drums, and that was the first band I was in, and we were called A Careful Workman Is the Best Safety Device. we knew that it wasn't going to be a long-lived band. We played one or two parties,
because you can't even get the title on a 7-inch.
No.
So tell me, because Superchunk was Chunk at first, right?
Yes, and so later we formed Chunk with Chuck Garrison, who was also in Zen Frisbee, by the way. In the phone book, was his name was misprinted as Chunk Garrison. And we took that as our band name. We were just like, okay, sure, that's funny. So you do these things lightly, not knowing that it's going to mean forever. And after we were around a few years, it turned out there was a New York noise collective called Chunk, and they sent us a cease and desist letter after we had put out 2 7-inches, telling us that we could not use the name. Mm-hmm. And so Mac's mom suggested Superchunk, and that's how we ended up with that.
When you start reaching, you said, as you didn't know how to play, you were reluctant even to do it at first. Now you're in the band, this first band. Now you're with Superchunk, and you're successful band. You're making it. You're recording you record a record with Matador on the Matador label. What was it like for you to really be a successful musician?
Well, I mean, at first I didn't feel like a successful musician at all. Like, I felt like confused, petrified, at a loss of what I was doing, you know. And then after a while, with repetition, it became more comfortable. Like, it was a few years probably before I felt comfortable playing on stage. And then, it started to feel really good. It's this strangely addictive feeling playing in front of people. And maybe, I don't know if everyone feels this, maybe I feel it more than other people because of my strange abilities, but there's an energy that you feel from people if they're enjoying a show that is incredible. It feeds you and inspires you to do your best and to play for them. And It's like a drug.
Yeah. Well, it's not all that surprising. I mean, if you think about Adam and the Ants and what you first saw there, here's this other, but they're performing in a way and they're succeeding. And so their otherness is somehow connecting. And I think feeling connection is hopefully still what we as a species want to do. I don't know how much longer we as a species will care about feeling what other people are feeling. But for now, we do. And so if you're tracking that and you're feeling a little left out, seeing somebody succeed at that, you know, would be something you'd be attracted to. And by golly, if you feel it yourself, that's not a bad addiction to have, wanting to connect with people.
Yeah. 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 And yeah, it did make me feel like more linked to the world than I had in a lot of ways for a long time. And it was a way for me to interact with people that didn't involve me having to talk to them so much. Which is weird, because I'm standing on stage, which is terrifying.
But you're in control.
Yes,
you've got, sort of. But I mean, it's your playlist. They have to, you know.
Right, right. And like, just playing bass was fine at a certain point. But if I had to say anything, then the wall was gone again, you know. Mm. And like, I felt scared and at odds.
You know, there's so many reviews where, in particular, women, but people talk about your performance on the stage and really connecting with the way you took the stage, your stance, your posture, your gestures. We're speaking to people, and hearing you now, I'm guessing, well, maybe you were, but you may not have been terribly conscious of those gestures. You weren't choreographing yourself, were you?
Oh, no, not at all. Like, it was a place of release.
Yeah.
It was like I got up there and I exercised all my demons, you know? And a lot of it was moving. I was furiously leaping around or flinging my head around, and which now I regret because I'm sure I did terrible things to my neck. it was an emotional outlet, and I'm sure that showed. And when Foolish came out, that was a record that was pretty much about me and Mac breaking up. We were romantically involved for a while, and then that record came out, and there was something about being on stage. Like, we made the decision to stay together as a band and to keep running the label together in spite of us breaking up, because it felt like, you know, already at that point, it felt like these were things that were bigger than the two of us, and that they were valuable to us and valuable to other people, and we should continue them. You let them keep going. But performing that record live was really hard and really emotional. And like, I would be up there crying. I don't know if anybody could see it, but like, that was intense.
Well, what was it like too? Because if you think about the intensity, this is your breakup album. Mm-hmm. You didn't promote it as such, but you look back at it that way. And it felt that way on stage. Mac is doing all the lyrics.
Right.
You're having to listen.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and that's part of what upset me. But also, I didn't want to write the lyrics. I didn't want to sing. But yeah, it felt unbalanced. And that sort of, like, his viewpoint was being projected and mine wasn't. And that upset me.
And yet you held it all together. The band and the label, Merge Records. Laura Balance kept her balance, co-founder of Merge Records, bassist of the indie rock band Superchunk. We've embedded a Merge Records playlist, by the way, at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll hear about Merge at 30, a summer event that celebrated three decades of Merge Records. First, Driveway to Driveway from Superchunk's 1994 album, Foolish. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking to Laura Balance today, indie rock icon, bassist for the indie rock group Superchunk, co-founder of Merge Records, which turns 30 this year. We've embedded the Merge Records Merge at 30 playlist at our website, stateofthings.org. You talked about Foolish, which was sort of the breakup album between you and Mac, and how difficult it was to be on stage and hear that. And now when you listen to it, I'm sure things are different for you.
Oh, definitely. Having some distance from it helps, and you know, those emotions not being so raw anymore. Now, you know, it's one of my favorite Superchunk records, partly because it's so emotional and present. Yeah. It makes a better record, I think. When you can hear what someone's feeling.
But that's the art, because you can hear what someone's feeling when they're crying about, you know, losing their boyfriend in the park or something like that, and that's not a record. You're not going to buy that, right?
No.
So then there's a certain amount of art in channeling that raw emotion, making it real, and also in a way that's objectively, you know, useful to other people in that way. Well, talk about Merge Records. How did that come about?
Around the same time that we started Superchunk, we started talking about starting a record label, and a collective of people had from the area had put out this box set together of 7 inches called "Evil I Do Not, To Not I Live," and the record label it was on was called Palindrome Productions, and Mac was involved. He was in this band Wax with Wayne Taylor from Raleigh, and Wayne and some other people had, like, Dana from the Black Girls, and they had all decided, like, we should do this, and they basically figured out how to get some 7 inches pressed. They silk screened onto blank tape boxes, like, that are about the same size as a 7-inch, mm-hmm. and they hand assembled all these things. Wow. And made like 500 of them and sold them locally. And that was, I think, a lot of the inspiration for us. That, like, we saw that, like, oh, you can do this. It's not rocket science. You get the parts and you put them together. And there were so many bands in the area that would be around for a while and then sort of dissolve out of lack of forward motion. Mm-hmm. And it felt like it would be awesome to document them, but also it would be awesome to give them some sort of material that they could send out into the world that would make it so, like, maybe they could go play a show in Chicago or D.C., you know, if there was some physical thing that, like, right. gave people an entry point. And also Mac was in a lot of bands, and he wanted all of those things to be preserved. So we just did it sort of on a whim.
But you've got this record label. As you say, you see the need. You see that it's something you can do. But Superchunk, what, your first two albums were not on Merge, right? They were with Matador?
No, so. Because we had started Merge as a kind of a hobby. And we started out doing cassettes and 7-inches. And we didn't feel like we had the capacity to put out full-length records. We didn't want to jump in that deep. And Superchunk had already progressed to the point where it felt like, you know, we should do an album. And Mac knew Gerard from New York, and he had started Matador, and we were, I think, like the second band they signed. And you know, we were signed along with Teenage Fan Club and this band called H.P. Zinker. Where are they now? Yeah. But so we had a contract to have several records with Matador, and then by the time that was up, we had been approached by Corey Rusk from Touch and Go because he was really interested in what we had been doing with Merge and the 7-inches we were putting out, and he offered to manufacture and distribute Merge records through Touch and Go, which is a great opportunity for us. We didn't have the money to print CDs, full-length LPs, and cassettes, which was right. what you had to do back then. And the wherewithal to distribute them and promote them while also being in a touring band.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't until our contract was up with Matador that we decided that we were at a point where we could put out a new Superchunk album ourselves.
On Merge.
Yeah.
So talk about the evolution and you know, groups like Arcade Fire, His Golden Messenger, She and Him. In fact, why don't we do that? Well, let's play a clip here. Arcade Fire takes home a Grammy when they were part of the Merge family. Let's listen to this from We Used to Wait from their 2010 album, The Suburbs. Arcade Fire, We Used to Wait from their Grammy-winning album, The Suburbs, a group that's part of the Merge family, and I'm talking with Merge co-founder Laura Balance. You know, talk about signing them and kind of where they were at the moment, your vision, and how things turned out.
Let's see. We wound up signing them because there was a Superchunk fan. His name is Howard Billerman, and this woman, Chantal, used to show up at all of our shows in Montreal. And they became really hardcore fans of the band and would, anytime we played on the East Coast, would follow us up and down. And Howard wound up starting a recording studio. And the Arcade Fire had come in and recorded in his studio. And he actually, something happened with their drummer while they were doing it, and he wound up playing drums for them. And so he sent us a burned CD with some Arcade Fire songs on it and said, I really think you guys should sign this band. And, you know, up here in Montreal, nobody can stop talking about them because there's, you know, their shows are so intense and amazing. And we listened to it, and it definitely, like, sounded good, but we're always so slow. We are very cautious. Mm. And it probably was a couple months of listening to it and kind of, you know, trying to decide before we finally went back to Howard and were like, yeah, let's do this. We really, you know, we would love to do this album. And they were apparently on the verge, like the paperwork had been drawn up for them to sign with some Canadian label. And they wound up putting the brakes on that, fortunately for us.
Wow.
And probably for them too. And wound up signing to Merge.
So let's talk about this diagram now. We've got this, the X and the Y axis here between the band, which is doing pretty well, and mm-hmm. then this hobby called Merge. And at some point, the lines cross in terms of who's making the money, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting to think about this thing that you thought was a hobby uh-huh. actually becoming kind of the main business.
Oh, yeah. Right? We signed them in 2004, and by then, like, Merge was 15 years old.
Yeah.
And in the first 10 years of Merge's existence, Superchunk was on a pretty intense touring schedule. And at some point, it became clear to us we needed to take a break. And around 2000, we quit making albums for a little while, and it enabled Mac and I to focus more on running Merge and actually be there for it. And prior to that, we had gone from having no employees and, you know, somebody, Ash Bowie from Polvo, checking the post office box to see if anybody had sent $5 to get a 7-inch to, like, having one or two employees, then four, you know, and it gradually building up. And by 2004, we were already in Durham and had maybe 10 employees or maybe less. I can't say for sure. But things had advanced to the point already, thanks to the Magnetic Fields, 69 Love Songs,
mm-hmm.
which was a runaway success. Like, we had no idea that was going to do as well as it did. In fact, we were very skeptical. You know, when Stephen Merritt said, I want to make a record with 69 songs on it. And we were like, well, that means 3 CDs. No one will buy that. That will be like $1 million. And
plus,
you know,
the songs are 8 seconds each. Go
ahead. Yeah. We're totally caught ill-prepared for the demand for that record. Then we also had a Lamb Chop record called Nixon that I was the first record where I felt that NPR helped us promote it. Like, it was the first time where I was like, oh my gosh, our age group is now there in the media. And now these things that we love are going to be reviewed, and it's this new platform. Besides, you know, not just college radio anymore. There's this, you know, growing up of my generation into professional jobs. And that record did really well for us by our standards.
Yeah, you know you're getting old when the music you like is on public radio. That's all I'm saying. That's how you know you're getting old.
And also, Neutral Milk Hotel. We had put out this Neutral Milk Hotel record that didn't do much when it first came out, but eventually became sort of like this record that every college kid has to discover.
But what's it like? So there you are, in a sense, growing up, maturing, changing, becoming actual business people. And we should talk about this too, because the touring and the live sets were really taking a toll on you and your health, right?
Right. It was hard on my back, but also mostly hard on my ears. From early on, felt that it was too loud and would, you know, often spend downtime between songs trying to figure out how to push Mac's amp so it wasn't angled towards me as much, or maybe I would walk over there and turn the volume down a little bit if he wasn't looking.
You were glad there was not an 11 on there.
Yes. Yeah. And pretty early on, I started wearing earplugs all the time. But it wasn't enough. And by 2000, I was realizing my ears hurt and were ringing a fair amount. But it wasn't until we got back together and made another record in, I think it was 2010, mm-hmm. And did some touring for that having had that downtime had made my ears feel a lot better. Mm-hmm. But then touring again, it felt like my bandmates had all gotten older and deafer and were louder even. And I couldn't take it. And after we finished touring for Majesty Shredding, that album, when we started to record another album, I basically told them, I'm happy to record with you guys because it's a controlled situation, but I can't play with you live on stage anymore because I want to be able to hear my daughter when I'm 60. And so at this point, I don't play live anymore. I have what I like to call my substitute. And I think of The Who every time I say that. but he's great. And I'm so grateful that he does it because I didn't quit for a long time because I was afraid it would mean the end of the band, that it would somehow be taking something away from all of our fans and taking something away from my bandmates who, it's their identity. It's part of who they are, being able to play Superchunk songs. I'm so grateful that they kept going and didn't take it as...
And you're still on the records.
I'm still on the records.
So I haven't given you a lot of time, but who are you excited about now, up and coming on Merge Records?
Well, let's see. We have a new His Golden Messenger record coming out in September, which is I'm really excited about.
And you've got kind of an R&B group, sort of a little bit outside the Merge, Ibibio sound, right?
Oh, well, they're more like, it's more like African pop.
Yeah.
They're amazing. They're from London. The lead singer is from Ghana, I think. Oh, geez.
Well, I tell you what. I'm going to say thank you. That's okay. And they're on Merge. So we're going to sign off now because we've got some of their music. And we'll let everybody hear it and decide for themselves.
Awesome.
But great to talk with you.
Great to talk with you.
Happy anniversary. Laura Balance, bassist for Superchunk, co-founder of Merge Records. You can find out more about the show at our website, stateofthings.org. We've also embedded Merge Records playlist at our website, and you can sign up for a newsletter and get a daily preview. Wizard of Oz coming up on Movies on the Radio. What was your experience of the Wizard of Oz? How did it affect you? SOT@WNC.org. You can be on State of Things. This is our show, which is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Moorman. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Here's the Merge Record Group, Ibibio Sound Machine, and their track, Give Me a Reason.